Charles Dew is one of America's most respected historians of the South and tells us about his life in the incredible new book, The Making of a Racist, A Southerner Reflects on Family, History, and the Slave Trade. He turns the focus on his own life, which began not in the halls of enlightenment, but in a society unequivocally committed to segregation. In the book, he recreates the mid-century American South of his childhood, in many respects, a boy's paradise, but one stained by lost cause revisionism and, worse, by the full brunt of Jim Crow. The centerpiece of Dew's story is a sobering discovery of a price. Charles Dew is Ephraim Williams Professor of American History at Williams College and the author of the Fletcher Pratt Award-winning Apostles of Disunion, and again, the name of the book is The Making of a Racist, A Southerner Reflects on Family History and the Slave Trade. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Charles Dew to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you,
Joe. A great pleasure to have you on the program. What brought you to want to tell this story?
I think it grew out of my teaching experience. I've been teaching Southern history almost since I began teaching. I was trained in that field in grad school, and I often found myself, when I was teaching, turning to my own experience to convey to students what it was like to grow up in a racist society. And I found that it didn't matter whether I was teaching the Old South or the New South, the stories I was telling were appropriate. And I also noticed that when I told these stories, I got the students' attention. They stopped gazing out the window and doing whatever else they were doing and focused in on me. And they generally not only listened, often came by my office to continue discussions.
At what point in your life did you realize that what you were living through was something that was different than the rest of the world, different than the rest of the country,
right?
And something that could be used as an example of this versus, what you experienced.
It wasn't until I got to college, I'm sorry to say. I had never been north of the Potomac. When I came to Williams as a freshman in 1954. And I remember walking into my dorm room on the Williams campus and meeting my roommates and then going out to meet the rest of the students in the entry. And I had an African-American classmate. And I had never had a conversation across the color line with someone who was African-American. I'd never had a conversation that wasn't really grounded in a sort of etiquette, racial etiquette, that governed the way white and black interacted in the South. This was a new experience for me, and I've often thought that my education began at Williams before I walked into a classroom, just having a classmate who was on the other side of the color line. So really, I was 17 years old before I started thinking about the South in any critical way.
And how much of your boyhood, I mean, you talk about this and you tell us about mid-century American South and at this time. And as you study the South and as obviously you reflect on your life, what you were going through, was there anything extraordinary happening that wasn't happening in the rest of the South, let's say?
In the area where
yes.
I grew up? I think St. Petersburg, Florida, was a very typical Jim Crow Southern town. People don't seem to realize that Florida was a very segregated, racist place for a long time. And the area where I grew up, it was cradle-to-grave segregation. So I had never known a culture that wasn't grounded in that Jim Crow legal circumstance until I got to Williams. So it was the process of absorbing the culture. I've used the word osmosis to describe it. You just sort of absorbed it. You drank it in without even having to be told a lot of the stuff. And I think every young person who grew up in that culture had a sort of searing experience where it came home to them.
We think of this so often about our religion, and we think about this even as our politics, that we tend to, by osmosis, take the religious beliefs that we mm-hmm. were brought up with, mm-hmm. take the political beliefs that we were often brought up with.
Sure.
And that this is very similar in that sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. You see how your parents behave. You see how people in your family, your aunts and uncles, your cousins, you learn that you never shake hands with an African American. You learn that you don't say Mr. or Miss or Mrs. You use first names. We had a separate bathroom for the domestic help that came to our house regularly. It was badly appointed off the back porch. We had a very nice tile bathroom on the second floor. Mm-hmm. We were not to use that bathroom that Illinois woman who worked for us for years, who was really vital in my learning about Jim Crow, our yard man, they used the Jim Crow bathroom, basically. It didn't say white or colored in our house, but it could have. The signs weren't up. Mm. But that's what it was.
There's the centerpiece to the book is this discovery of a price circular.
Yeah.
This is from what, 1860?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a moment that sort of seared in my experience.
So give us a sense of what happened and how you become changed after that.
I had been teaching at Williams for several years, and the rare book librarian called me over to the Chapin Library, which is our wonderful rare book library, and he had just made a purchase. And this was a price circular issued by an auction house, a slave auction house in Richmond, Virginia. And he said, I have something I'd like to show you. And he handed this to me, and I looked at it, and I had a gut-wrenching experience. I thought, this is who my people were. This is who my antebellum white Southern ancestors were. They generated this trade. They generated this document, not specifically, personally, but they were responsible. And there on a single page was the essence of slavery. Human beings as property, priced. Men, women, and children. Children priced by height, beginning at 4 feet. And I looked at this document and I said to myself, I have ancestors who couldn't see what was right in front of them, just like I couldn't see what was right in front of me in the Jim Crow South. I think that business of not seeing is what really drove me to write this book, in part about myself and then a part about my ancestors and slavery.
You mentioned this, but tell us a little bit about Illinois Brown and Culver. This is the woman who devoted years of her life, decades
yes,
of her life,
yes.
to serving your family.
She did. My book is dedicated to her. When I got to Williams and began seeing a different world, when I would go home, I would volunteer to drive her home. She lived across town. Because I wanted to talk to her. I wanted to find out what life was like for her and her husband, Joe. I knew their son, Roosevelt, had left the South. They had stayed. And I remember the drive one day, I broke the ice. I said, you know, it's really not right, Illinois, that people like your son, Roosevelt, have to leave the South to get ahead to find a decent job. And I saw her glance over at me. And I said, okay, I'm going to finish. It's too bad something like race makes it impossible. And I think that broke the ice, as I hoped it would, and put us on the same page. And that opened up a whole range of discussions with her about what it was like living on the other side of the color line. She was really instrumental in helping me get rid of what I call this reptilian skin of racism. She helped me shed it.
She said to you, why do the grown-ups put so much hate in the children?
That was an incredibly profound thing. I don't remember the background to the conversation. I think we were talking about some of these crazy Jim Crow customs that had grown up. And she looked across the car and she said, Charles, why do the grown-ups put so much hate in the children? And I've come to think that was a really amazing insight, because as I thought back on my own experience, racism had been passed along almost like a genetic trait.
Mm-hmm.
It had been absorbed. It had been almost bred into the marrow of my bones, it seemed. And when she said, why do the grown-ups put so much hate in the children? She was acknowledging the reality. Children don't come into the world prejudiced. They learn it. And I started learning it in my family. It's a sad commentary, but it's the truth.
Were there challenges for you in, as you say, shedding that reptilian skin?
Yes. It led to a serious breakup with my father. My father was a lawyer and a very good lawyer, but he was also very prejudiced. He bought into Jim Crow 100%. Mm-hmm. And among the things that he used to rave and rant about was the Brown decision, 1954, school integration, which he dismissed as unconstitutional and the judges trying to ram their doctrine down the throats of the American people. And I was home during the spring vacation of my senior year, and we were having dinner. And he got going on the Brown decision. And I just couldn't take it anymore. And I said, Pop, I think I know more about American constitutional history than you do. And he went silent. And he didn't. I left the next day to go back to college. He didn't say very much, if anything, to me before I left. My mother called me when I got back to school. She said, Charles, you've got to call your father and apologize. And I literally sat down to think about it because I had finally walked away from that culture. Mm-hmm. But as I thought about it, I thought I loved my father. He'd been a good father in many ways, and so I made the call. I don't recall the details, but I did apologize. He accepted. And from that point on, we talked about everything but race, particularly being in the South, football. And
sure.
He didn't goad me. I didn't goad him. I think we sort of reached a point of armistice. He knew I wasn't going to change. I knew he wasn't going to change. So we just didn't bring it up.
It's what so many adults of people who come into adulthood often face, of if their parents have are alcoholics or abusers, and then we are given that opportunity to either mirror that behavior mm-hmm. or fight like hell against mm-hmm. it. And so for you in this case, it was a conscious effort to sort of de-racism you, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
to sort yeah. of scour you of these thoughts, which I right. assume, because implicit in all of this is that all white people deep down have a certain degree of racism, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Just because of our culture. It's not inbred, it's acquired. And I think that it's been manifest in every part of the country. The South had a legal system of racial segregation. The rest of the country had plenty of bigotry and plenty of racism. And I think it's a problem we're coping with now. I think the political climate in the country right now makes my book timely. I wish it weren't so, but I think it is. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was in the hope that some people who grew up on my side of the color line would learn something. And I hope that African American people, particularly kids, would get some idea of how all this stuff came into being. Mm. I mean, I can imagine a black child saying at some point early on in their life, where did this come from? What did I do to deserve this? And I've had several people contact me and who are African American and thank me for really helping them understand for the first time how something they've been puzzled about most of their lives has come into being. And they will tell me, they were 5, 6 years old when they first realized what was going on. My first experience happened when I was 8 years old on the white side. I saw my father just explode in rage to a black man who came to the wrong door of our house. Mm-hmm. Instead of using the back door, he came to the side door. And my father flew into a rage. I had never heard him speak like that before. I can't remember what he said. I think I was too scared. But I was 8 years old, and that was my first experience that this notion of crossing the color line was serious business. People who are African American experience the same thing, not from the point of view of the oppressor, but the point of view of the oppressed. I was on the first side of that equation, they're on the latter. And I hope that, what I've said here will help them realize some of this toxic racism that they've had to experience.
Charles Dew is our guest. The name of the book is The Making of a Racist. A Southerner reflects on family history and the slave trade. As you said, you hope that this remains you feel that the book is quite timely. Do you, looking at where we are in the political contest, which seems to just be unraveling before our eyes here, but when you look at it, how large a part do you think race plays in this current campaign?
I think it's a key ingredient. I don't know. I can't put a percentage on it. I think economic insecurity drives a lot of anxiety right now. But I can't help but think that a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment that's coursing through the country has a racist tinge. I think there's a tendency among some whites who feel that they have been treated unfairly and benefits have been given to people across the color line who don't deserve them. I don't think that's confined to one section of the country. I think that's around in other places as well. I think race is very much a part of what's driving our politics right now. And as I said, I wish it weren't so, but it seems to me very much that it is.
And when you look at the numbers, and again, it's you're absolutely right. I mean, it's impossible to put a percentage on it, but mm-hmm. but you look at the amount of support that we see in the polls, mm-hmm. and say that 30-40%, mm-hmm. and you just think of that as a baseline,
right?
And now race may not be entirely making that up, but it certainly gives you an idea that we have a huge problem that we have yet to overcome.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do. It's our great unfinished business as a democracy, in my opinion, living up to the all men are created equal wording of the Declaration of Independence.
So what's fascinating in your book is that while you are coming to this realization that, oh, yes, there's also a civil rights movement that's going on.
Right.
As all of this is happening. So
right.
That has to play, right? That plays completely into your, I don't know, is salvation too far? Is that too heady a word? I don't know.
I think I would buy into that, Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that really plays into it for
it
you.
It does. It does. I started reading the New York Times when I was at Williams. I wouldn't have done that if I'd been at a Southern university or college.
Right.
I had an experience on campus. A man came, he was a Charleston newspaper editor, came to defend segregation, challenged the Brown decision. This was 1955. I was a sophomore. I had used a phrase Abraham Lincoln used in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, defending white supremacy in class to defend segregation. And my teacher saw me come into the auditorium, and he pointed to me and he said, Charles, you ought to be up there on stage with that editor.
Mm.
And that editor turned out to give probably the most boring, devoid of intellectual content talk I'd ever heard. And I thought to myself as I left, is this what I've been defending?
Yeah.
And there were just moments like that in my college career that just rocked me back on my heels and made me think. My classmates, stuff I experienced on the train going home, Jim Crow dining cars, an uncle in South Carolina, a pediatrician, wonderful doctor, had white and black patients, joined the White Citizens Council. You know, I started saying, what's going on? And by the time I finished Williams, I had come to the view that the way I had been raised was, as I said earlier, toxic, and that I had to get out from under it. And so I've been trying to do that ever since. I think it's why I'm teaching Southern history. Still trying to come to grips with it.
You talk about some of the parental challenges, but I mean, was one just going up into this land of Yankees and going to college?
That was critical, and I went there because my father wanted my older brother and I to go there. My father had been to New York and talked to lawyers on various businesses, and he had a measure of what made a person educated. If they wrote well and spoke well, he mm-hmm. asked them where they'd gone to college. And a disproportionate number of the men he met had gone to Williams. So he looked into it. He hadn't heard of the place, looked into it, liked what he saw, told my other brother to go there. My brother wanted to go to University of Virginia, as I've said, and major in fraternity life. That was my father's school. And he said, no, John, I want you to try Williams for a year. If you don't like it, you can transfer. He loved it. So I just toddled along after him. And I loved it, too. But it's because of my father's belief in education, liberal arts, and I think his conviction that we wouldn't change, that the armor in which we were clad, the racist armor in which we were clad, was impenetrable.
I mean, not to overanalyze this, but I mean that's the fascinating part, mm-hmm. because yeah. You're going to a liberal arts school. So we use the word liberal. That is part of it, right? Yeah. But you're going to the Northeast, and it's very different.
I think he felt that he called it the basics, these Southern values, racial values. I think he thought they were as inbred in us as good manners, that we'd been taught a certain way, raised a certain way, we believed a certain way. It was his way of belief, and we were going to stick with it.
How diverse was the college at the time?
It was not nearly as diverse as it is now. There were a number of black students in my class, not a large number. It was much more white shoe, as the expression goes, than it is now. But I had black classmates, including a friend in my dorm. The numbers of Jewish students was not large, but we had substantial numbers of Jewish students. We had a handful of black students, and most of us were all male then, and most of us were Caucasian. The college had been integrated since the 19th century. It had a rich history of bringing bright African-American kids to campus, but not in large numbers.
How long were you away before you returned as a professor?
I taught at state universities for 14 years, was asked to come back to Williams as a visitor, and an opening occurred the year I was there, and they ran a search and made me the job offer. So and my family decided to stay. It was convenient. My wife and our two boys had lived there for a year, so we could make a family decision that mm-hmm. this was a good place for us to settle.
Been there ever since.
Been there ever since.
For other, and just we only have about half a minute left, but when you look ultimately what you hope people get out of this, I mean, is it that we can erase these parts of ourselves?
I hope so. That really is why I wrote this. I hope that it will be enlightening and will enlighten both white and black readers and maybe help us get past some of the worst parts of our culture.
It is a powerful and beautiful memoir. It is The Making of a Racist. A Southerner reflects on family, history, and the slave trade. Charles Dew, thank you very much for coming with us. Give our best to our friends at Williams, and it's a great honor to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.